Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Jay Powell's Federal Reserve making its boldest move yet in the fight to curb inflation, calling for the first 75 basis point interest rate increase since 1994. Tim, it was a big one.
It was a big one. Powell also signaling that another such increase could come in July, and yet the federal funds rate is far from America's biggest economic concern right now. Our cover story will explain why in just a moment.
Also ahead on our broadcast, the outgoing CEO of the world's largest cruise vacation company talking about the prospects for a global recession. Also, the CEO of SunPower telling us why the time to shift to solar, it's now. And we'll check in on the retail environment. We'll do that with fashion entrepreneur Tory Burch.
Yeah, some great voices on this weekend edition of the program. All of that to come. We begin with this week's cover story, though. It does come from the remarks section of Bloomberg Business Week, courtesy of assistant managing editor at the magazine, Jim Ellis. High inflation rattling Americans in part because it makes them feel like things are spiraling out of control. And there are plenty of signs that they are. Jim and Business Week editor Joel Weber explain.
It makes you go to some dark places really quick. And that is because of the nature of the last year and the spike that we've seen in inflation. It has been something that Americans who have not had a sense of what inflation means is suddenly it is gripping the country, and it is leading to all kinds of anxieties, and that's reverberating across markets and everything else. And so, I turned to Jim Ellis early in the cycle and said, you know, Jim, you're elder statesman on the staff. You lived through the 70s and 80s at Business Week. We've asked you to write about this stuff before. Can you kind of give us a toehold in it? And then, you know, between the Fed and the markets and everything this week, it really, to me, what Jim ended up writing was really this sense of what it all means, right? So, Jim, I'm just curious, like, I'll take Tim's question on Shiller and kind of bring that back to you. Why is inflation such a, like, almost like a cancer for sanity?
I guess at its core, it's because it's one of those things that people, A, don't truly understand, certainly don't understand it in the way that economists do, but don't really have a clear definition for what it is, but they sort of know when it's there. And they're afraid of it. And I think they're most afraid of it because it's one of those things that can affect the quality of their life at the same time they have very little control over. And because of that, people are terrified of it. And, an economist might tell you, well, there can be some good things about inflation. Inflation starts moving, if prices are, if wages start moving up, then, you know, particularly for people who are either outside the labor force or people at the bottom of the labor force, maybe that's a good thing. But you won't find anyone, as Shiller in his research tried, they didn't find a single soul of the hundreds of people they interviewed who actually thought that inflation was a good thing.
Jim, I wanted to go back to something that Joel said. You know, he said that you were writing about this stuff in the 1970s. You were at Business Week, and you wrote about this in the fall, inflation in the fall, and you made some parallels to what you experienced in the 1970s. And I'm wondering now, a few months later, as inflation has continued to creep up and move higher, if you are starting to fear more than you did back in the fall, that we are indeed entering some sort of thing that was similar to what you experienced in the 70s?
In a way. I mean, obviously there are some rather significant differences between now and the 70s. I mean, back then we did have, we had product shortages that were really important because we had energy shortages, both in, 73 and in 79, where we had, gas lines. I mean, today you can get gas if you can afford $5, $6 a gallon. You can get it. And also, we had significantly higher unemployment rates back then than we have now. And now we have a labor shortage still from post-pandemic. And so in a lot of ways, we're in a better place than we were in the 70s, obviously. But one thing that really rings true here, in a similarity to the 70s, is that there is a feeling that there are other things afoot. There are other things beyond just the continual rise in prices that are making people feel uneasy and out of control and with their existence. I mean, right now we have everything from the pandemic that doesn't seem to want to end. The idea that, we have a government system that we don't know if we are in control of, if we can trust. We have a president who says that the very basis of democracy, the idea of, sort of transfer of power, the integrity of elections is all put to question. We have a lot of things that are making people feel uneasy. And so to sort of get a handle on this, I talked to a number of sort of researchers, including economists who think about behavior. And they're saying that when people are afraid, they tend to be afraid of everything, and that being afraid of one thing, if you have multiple sources of discomfort, it actually sort of makes you feel even worse. And so right now, it's very real to say we do have rising prices. So we do have inflation, but at the same time, people feel uncomfortable about government. They feel uncomfortable about safety of, with guns and safety of schools. And all of a sudden, it means that you're pushed to the end where you sort of think everything's going to hell. I mean, the Fed is, they're in the position of being, at least if the 70s is any guide, I mean, that is, the one body that can bring an end to this. I mean, you can beat inflation. The problem is that to beat inflation, you often have to beat down the economy to the point that the people who will love you for it will eventually hate you for it.
That was Bloomberg Business Week Assistant Managing Editor Jim Ellis, along with the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber.
Coming up, a warning from the CEO of SunPower on what could be a difficult summer for America's power grid and how his company stands to benefit.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we caught up with him back in March, and as someone who has worked at Amazon, he wants to make using solar power for the home as easy as buying a book.
Peter Faricy is chairman, president, and CEO of SunPower. It's a renewable energy company. It's got a market cap of just about $3 billion, and that could go up if the cost of energy continues to rise, as it has been for much of 2022.
Well, you're right. It's shocking to see the increases. Utility bills are rising 10-15%, and it's really hitting consumers.
Our energy went up 3x.
You hear a lot of these stories across the country, but what I can tell you on the demand side is it's very strong. We grew 40% in the first quarter, and despite raising some of our prices due to supply chain costs, demand in the second quarter, we haven't finished the second quarter yet, but I expect it to grow even faster than it did in Q1. So we've been very pleased so far. I think between high energy prices and worries about blackouts, people are really getting the message. Solar and battery storage, is the way to go.
It's interesting that you say it. My energy company reached out to me recently and wanted to put me in connection with a solar company to see if I wanted to, you know, kind of put some panels up on my roof and stuff. So, and that just happened in the last week. Was it the weekend or something?
What's their interest in doing that? Like, why would they want you to do that? Is it to decrease the demand from the grid?
I think they all are increasingly, right? And help us out here, Peter. I mean, all companies increasingly have to reduce their carbon footprint. So if they can somehow, right, source out to more greener ways, that's part of their business strategy.
I think many of the forward-thinking utilities, exactly. They want to reduce the amount of carbon footprint. They're getting a lot of political pressure. But also, you know, when the grid is at its most stressed point, they have to light up these peaker plants. And these peaker plants are typically either coal or gas. They're very destructive on the environment because they can't run them very efficiently. So their goal is really to get, you know, the forward-thinking utilities are thinking, how can we get as much residential solar out there? And I'm not sure if you guys have heard about these concepts of virtual power plants, but it's kind of a concept that utilities will pay for consumers to take their solar battery energy and send it back to the grid when the grid is most stressed, which is usually 6 to 7 p.m. and we all get home and flip on our, you know, our TVs and air conditioning and everything else. So there's a lot of really good ideas out there that I think are win-win. I'm glad, Carol, you live in a place where your utility is thinking that direction. Yeah.
Sunny New Jersey, right?
Yeah, it's urban and my roof isn't very big, but I got to tell you, if the, you know, the price is right, I'd kind of love to do it. One thing I do want to ask you, and I love this about peaker plants, peakers. I was just like Googling. I had no idea that that's what they're referred to. Hey, Peter, I gotta though take a step back, and we do this with all the leaders.
Yeah.
So much market volatility. You know, we're all like on pins and needles about what the Fed's going to do tomorrow. And I do wonder how does. I mean, your stock has seen a lot of pressure. I think down more than 30% from the early April high. Your market cap has shrunk. So has most of the equity universe. To be fair, so volatility, tricky outlook, higher rate environment. What kind of pressures is putting on you guys? How do you think about it? And do you have outlook? Do you feel like we're going to hit a recession?
Well, I'm not qualified to answer the recession question.
Yes, you are. Yeah, you run a business. You run a business. You have to make decisions.
Yeah, here's what I would say. Right now, we have the high class problem of trying to keep up with customer demand. So I am chasing labor to get more and more installation capacity across the U.S. And as you guys know from all the people you talk to, you're never sleeping very well with the supply chain every night. Mm. So we're constantly seeking more production of more panels and more components. So our really my exclusive focus right now is not on the market. It's really on there's so much demand out there. You know, we're at a point now where we're going to have our third straight quarter of record backlog. Obviously, that's a wonderful signal about how much people love our products and want them. But, you know, listen, consumers want stuff done fast.
Let's say there is a recession or there is this pullback in consumer demand. We're seeing it in terms of consumer sentiment with the way that consumers are feeling. We know they're concerned about inflation. We know high energy prices are eating into their wallets. And it's not just energy for, you know, powering the home. It's, of course, filling up the car as well, Peter. At what point do they start to pull back on purchasing solar or financing solar? Like, what is the calculation that you guys have done when it comes to this type of data?
Yeah. So most of our customers are telling us today that they're saving, you know, $100 a month when they install solar.
Even after paying for the outlay.
Even after paying for solar. Yeah. So I think as long as they continue to save money, I don't expect that any kind of recession issue will have an impact, because at the end of the day, the equation for consumers is really easy. Am I going to save money on this if I take a lease or a loan?
Okay, so let me ask the question.
And right now, that's what people are seeing.
Let me ask the question a different way, because our Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Commodity Strategist, Mike McGlone, came on earlier with us and talked about this being peak oil right now. And that's his prediction that we'll start to see energy prices come down. What happens if and when we start to see energy prices come down and my energy bill goes back to what it was 2 years ago rather than what it was last month? Then does demand dry up for solar?
I don't think so. And here's why. So over the last decade, solar prices have come down roughly 70 or 80%. So it's really a much more affordable product than it used to be.
Hey, one thing we want to ask you, and I'm going to be, you know, props to our Brian Eckhouse, who's like, hey, you're talking to Peter, you got to ask him about this. President Biden, you know, looking to kind of diffuse, I guess it's safe to say, a really very complicated trade dispute that has paralyzed the U.S. solar industry. And, you know, he's imposing this 2-year freeze on new tariffs for solar imports, invoking the Defense Production Act to support U.S.-made panels. I don't know that it affects you guys specifically, but how does it, or how do you think about this? And do you think your company's share prices maybe suffered because of it?
Well, I'm excited about where they want to get to, especially in 2 years, where they really want to incent, you know, onshore production of solar panels. I think that's fantastic. Carol, we announced at our analyst day a couple months ago that we're in late stage discussions with a company called First Solar. They're very famous because they're based here in the U.S. and they make their panels here in the U.S. So I think there's just a great opportunity as we move forward to get more and more of this industry production onshore. Having said all that, you're right. The decision that he made to sort of postpone any action there had no impact on our business. But what it basically did is it will continue to keep prices low because it will allow companies to source panels from all parts of the world, including China. And it will make sure that there's continues to be great value in buying solar, particularly, again, compared to traditional energy prices.
Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, an update from what our next guest calls the American Riviera, South Florida, and specifically Miami Beach.
One of the region's most prolific real estate agents tells us how much rising mortgage rates, inflation, and recession fears are squeezing her clients. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
We want to get to our next guest. She was named the number one national agent at Douglas Elliman, some $750 million in sales volume last year alone, deals in and around Miami Beach, Bal Harbor. Am I saying it right? Bal Harbor? I don't know.
I'm shaking my head.
She's going to help me with this. And we're going to get into a look at really real estate overall, and in particular, Florida.
Dina Goldentare is the executive director of sales at Douglas Elliman. She joins us via Zoom.
I'm thinking of Maine, right?
From
Bar
Miami
Harbor.
Beach. Bar
That's
Harbor.
Right.
Yeah. Dina, how are you?
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you with us. Well, help us understand what the market's looking like, because we did just read that article by our own Prashant Gopal talking about how we are seeing a decline in sales of homes in West Palm Beach, Florida. So just give us an idea of what you're seeing.
Sure. So the market that I specialize in really is the Miami Beach marketplace, which is pretty much our American Riviera. what we have seen the last 2 years has been uncharacteristic because people couldn't travel. So rather than going to Europe or to Aspen or to the Hamptons, we had some of the wealthiest people in the world quarantining and hanging out in Miami Beach. So we had this nonstop flow of activity, whereas usually things do slow down for us in June, July, and August, and then everyone starts trickling back down for fall. So I am hoping that the slowdown that I'm seeing here is the reflection of that time-tested pattern and hopefully not much more.
Well, yeah. So that's what we're trying to figure out. Like, what is the financial market? So much, you know, we talk about it, Dina, all the time. We just talked about how some of the elite private schools in Florida are getting crowded because so much of Wall Street has gone to Wall Street South down in Florida. Trying to get an idea of, is there a slowdown, though, because of the financial market impact and people, like, I don't know, you've seen a lot of cycles. What's your expertise telling you?
I mean, I'm naturally inclined to be an optimist, so I'm hoping that, again, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. So some of the deals I was working on, the buyers jetted off to Europe early this year because they haven't been in 2 years. They went out west early this year, and when you're not in Miami, it's really hard to get someone excited about a $10, $20, $30 million house. I do believe that when they return, let's say in October, that I can revive those deals, but I did see some things that I was working on not come together when people's stock portfolios were making them cry.
Dina, I'm wondering what's going on when it comes to, you know, we were talking about decline in prices and decline in interest around the country. The housing market is certainly seeing moderating demand. I'm wondering how much this has to do with rising mortgages and how you're thinking about, you know, at what level do we start to see mortgages really start to hit demand? Right. I mean, I know it has already, but like, what's the number you think about?
Well, where I'm seeing the mortgage interest rates be high affect price points so far has really just been in one sector of my marketplace, which is 3 to 5 million, which in Miami Beach is not, you know, it's not the top tier of the marketplace. It's like a mid place. And in that price point, we've seen inventory really dramatically increase and buyers have several listings to choose from, whereas in 90 days they did not. So that's just one sector, and I hate to use one sector to generalize the whole marketplace because my listings above 10 million, my listings above 20 million, I'm showing more than my listings in lower price points.
So, you know, it's interesting. Tim and I had a conversation yesterday about rents in New York City in particular, and I know Florida and Southern Florida is really your world, but it was about kind of record rents and just crazy. Sure. And we're like, what happened to everybody leaving New York City? It's like, what has happened in this real estate market?
Well, I think if you're a believer that people are not going to be buying as much because they're concerned about interest rates, then you have to be a believer that they want to rent. So if they're going to be renting, it's going to make the rental market even hotter.
So if people aren't buying, you're saying, right?
No, I'm saying if you're a believer that the market's going to slow down because people don't want to buy, the rates are too high, then what are they going to do? They're going to go rent.
What do you hear from your colleagues in New York just in the last 20 seconds that we have with you about slowing? Are we going to see a slowdown in New York when it comes to sales?
I'm not sure. Nobody's complaining. I mean, everyone's still, you know, really crushing it, but we haven't really seen the after effects. You know, the deals that are closing in my market, there's sales millions of dollars above ask. So we're still riding high because those deals happened 60 days ago, and they're just closing now.
Dina, 5 seconds. Is it U.S. buyers or outside the U.S.? Real quickly.
It's always been U.S., but the outside U.S. buyers are back now, and hopefully one of them will buy my $100 million listing at Golden Beach.
That was Dina Goldentare. She's Executive Director of Sales over at Douglas Elliman.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. As we just heard, Miami is home to a hot housing market, and it's also home to the world's largest cruise ship company. Up next, our exclusive interview with Carnival President and CEO, Arnold Donald.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Back in late April, Carnival named a new CEO to take over August 1st. Arnold Donald has been in that top spot since July of 2013, steering the company through a series of tough times, and that, of course, Tim, includes the pandemic.
Donald is poised to become the company's vice chairman in August. Until then, he remains in charge of the world's largest cruise vacation company, He joined us for an exclusive interview this past week. And Carol, you began by asking him about the chances that we may be facing a global recession in the near term.
We're prepared to try to weather that storm. We have sufficient liquidity. We've done over $29 billion of financial transactions since the beginning of COVID, this COVID period. And so we are well positioned with liquidity. As we said in the last, I can't give a full business update now because we're between quarters, but from the last business update we gave at that time, we had 3/4 of the fleet sailing. Occupancy on those ships that were sailing was starting to increase. Obviously, the pandemic has taken a turn for the better more recently, and you can see protocols beginning to be relaxed and restrictions lifted in many areas, which bodes well for travel in general in our business. And so, you know, we see an opportunity to generate cash, accelerate repayment of debt over time, ultimately, obviously, creating shareholder value. So recessions, if recession comes, if there's additional global tensions, which, you know, there's always somewhere in the world every year, something going on, natural disasters, all of that, you know, we're an industry and we're a business and a company, you know, engineered to weather through storms. And eventually we'll be getting back to the kind of cash generation that we're known for.
Do you know when?
I wish I knew when. I wish I had that crystal ball, Carol. Come on. Yeah. But I don't know exactly when, but, you know, as we said in the last business update, we're expecting to be, you know, pretty much at full operations in 2023, if not before. And that's what we said in the last business update. We'll be giving an update here in another week or so. And we'll see where we are. But you know, it's we see a lot of fundamentals that are positive despite these other macro dynamics, which are obviously less positive and currently reflected in the market.
Are your pricing power, is that one of the positives? Because I am curious about how you are dealing with the increase in bunker fuel costs. You know, are you able to raise prices to kind of offset some of the higher costs? And again, I talked about higher food costs, higher labor. Are you able to raise ticket prices?
You know, again, we're a global business. And so we can't just hit a switch and automatically raise prices because fuel prices have gone up. If there's sustained increase in fuel prices, as opposed to spikes and troughs, if there's a sustained high level of fuel pricing, obviously that will ultimately get reflected in the cost to the traveler. But right now we have, you know, pent up demand, somewhat limited capacity because we're not operating at 100% yet. And those are good tailwinds. Obviously, we do have the headwinds of higher fuel prices and still some restrictions in a number of the world in terms of number of areas in the world in terms of protocols and constraints on being able to sail at full occupancy in terms of accessing complete pools of guests who would like to sail with us. So, you know, we're managing through all that. The overall longer term picture, though, Carol, is really, you know, positive for the industry and certainly positive for our.
One thing I like talking about you, and I said to you, Arnold, you've dealt with a lot of crises, certainly at the company in specific, and you've seen a lot of different economic cycles, certainly, as you said, as you were chairman or on the board at Carnival, and then, of course, as running the company. So how is it we're at such an interesting time right now, right, dealing with higher inflation, this tight labor market, a Fed that is increasingly going to be, it seems, more and more aggressive. It feels really uncomfortable and complicated. How do you kind of make sense of it? And what can you say? Do you see any kind of easing in some of the supply chain pressures? Is there anything out there? You talk about consumer demand. Do you have a lot of confidence that that keeps coming, you know, for a while? Or do you start to see some weakness there?
No, we, again, as I mentioned, we're not recession-proof. Historically, we've been recession-resilient. And right now, we certainly see pent-up demand. People want to travel. You know, they want to share experiences. You know, they really are looking for experiences. So those are the tailwinds. There's constraints around that today, but those constraints are becoming fewer and less in terms of just the ability to feel that they can travel with certainty, not be concerned if they leave the country that they can get back in, not being concerned when they get to the airport whether they're going to be able to board the plane or not, or whether the plane is actually going to go or not. And so as those concerns evaporate, when you start having to fly, go to different countries, not sure what the rules are going to be when you land, what are going to be when you come back, you know, obviously that impedes demand. So as those uncertainties evaporate, that pent up latent demand for people to have experience, to want to travel and experience. That's ultimately what drives our business. And it's what we're really great at. And we do it at a value that's much better than equivalent land-based vacation.
Arnold, I'm wondering specifically when it comes to Europe, because Carol and I last month were at the Milken Institute Global Conference, and one theme that came up over and over again was concern about Europe's economy. But you yourself said you can't paint the entire region with a single brush. Talk to us about regional differences that you're seeing when it comes to economies right now, and if you're seeing pockets of strength versus pockets of weakness in some areas.
Well, just through the lens we look at from cruising, you know, obviously, we're not going to Russia right now. You know, St. Petersburg was a destination on a lot of itineraries, especially in the summertime. There were very high yielding itineraries. It's a very popular destination, et cetera.
Do you think you'll ever go back?
Ever is a long time. So ever, I'm sure.
Well, at some let me ask the question a different way.
In the near term,
What would need to happen in order to get St. Petersburg back on your itinerary?
Well, first of all, there needs to be peace. Mm-hmm. And, that's first and foremost. And then from there, we would have to see what, the restrictions are, the sanctions are, et cetera, if there are any and so on. But we believe in going to places where people want to go and where the locals want people to come. So we do believe in doing that. And within, of course, our ultimate responsibilities and our top priority, compliance, environmental protection, and the health, safety, and well-being of everyone. So we're going to be in compliance with local as well as international and our home state and flag state regulations. So it'll take that it's okay to go from a compliance and regulatory standpoint, and it would take that it's safe for people to go and it serves the best interests of health for everyone involved.
Arnold, you CEO for 9 years, on the board for much longer than that. What didn't you get to do that you wish you had?
That's a great question. There are always things that you wish you had had a chance to do. One of the biggest things is that we are celebrating 50-year birthday of our Carnival brand and our corporation. And the brand has done a very nice job of celebrating 50 years for the brand. But I really wanted to do kind of a blowout thank you celebration for 50 years for our corporation. And I didn't get to do that because it would have been inappropriate in the environment we were in with the pandemic. And also, given the fact that, we had paused for such a long time and weren't generating, positive earnings. And so, but I would have loved to have done a grand, celebration honoring the great legacy that Mickey Arison, the Arison family, all the people that have worked in this corporation, all of the partners who have supported it, the travel agent professionals, the ports, the destinations, the tour operators, all the people that depend on cruise for their livelihood, but have been, good partners for us. I would have loved to have done that. And unfortunately, we kind of had to take a quieter approach on that. So I have to leave it for Josh for the 75th celebration. Hopefully I'll still be around to participate.
So we've only got about a minute left here. And you said, you're going to be around for a while and make sure everything goes. And, I know you wouldn't give me a time. But is there something after this? I mean, in terms of the corporate world or something? Politics? Anything?
Politics. I don't think so in politics, that's for sure. I have a number of partners that I've worked with in the past, private equity and others. And so I'll look at, as a sitting CEO, I can only be on one corporate board other than my own. Not as a sitting CEO, there may be some additional board opportunities. But I'm also going to think about maybe becoming a news anchor, but now I'm kidding, guys.
I was like, wait, there's the red headline across
there
the
no,
Bloomberg.
No openings here, okay? Openings.
You can come, sorry, Tim, but Arnold can come and co-anchor with me anytime.
All right, maybe just once.
We look forward to future conversations wherever you go. You've always been gracious with us and finding time for us. We wish you well, and I know we'll be talking again. Arnold, thank you so much. Be well.
Carol. Thank you, Tim. You guys do a great job. Thank you very much.
That's Arnold Donald, President and CEO of Carnival Corporation. He will become vice chairman in August. And that wraps up our first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovec. Ahead in our next hour, more on the Federal Reserve's fight to tamp down inflation and the potential consequences of its strategy.
Plus, we'll catch up with fashion entrepreneur Tory Burch on the state of her business and her philanthropic pursuits.
This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
And we got plenty ahead this hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including a conversation with renowned fashion designer, entrepreneur, and philanthropist, Tory Burch.
Plus how AB InBev's commitment to ESG extends all the way to your local bar. First up this hour, though, more on the Fed's efforts to tame soaring prices.
We're strongly committed to returning inflation to our 2% objective. Inflation has again surprised to the upside. Some indicators of inflation expectations have risen, and projections for inflation this year have been revised up notably. In response to these developments, the committee decided that a larger increase in the target range was warranted at today's meeting. Clearly, today's 75 basis point increase is an unusually large one, and I do not expect moves of this size to be common.
Those words from Federal Reserve Chairman Jay Powell's press conference Wednesday after the central bank's biggest single rate hike in nearly three decades.
It was a big, big meeting. We were all counting down to it. Now, in a story you'll find online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, also on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg News senior markets editor Ed Harrison explains why the Fed's push to keep the U.S. economy on stable ground could actually help usher in a recession.
They haven't really tried historically to protect Main Street, at least for the last 40 years. What happened is that in the 70s, when we had our last inflation shock, there was a dreaded wage price spiral that people believe Paul Volcker was able to stamp out. And since then, they've sort of, you know, preemptively hiked rates at the end of every cycle. And so people who are just getting onto the employment ladder at the end of cycles were stopped out, you know, they were left behind. And then we had the great financial crisis, which was a trauma for everyone, and we got the bailouts for Wall Street. So there was a sense in which the Fed actually wasn't working for Main Street, and they've changed that approach to become more inclusive. Their staffing has become more inclusive. They've tried to lengthen business cycles on purpose in order to make it more inclusive. But unfortunately, they ran into the buzzsaw called inflation.
Right. So, I mean, I love how your story reads, to be quite honest with you, you know, Ed, that in terms of what happened during the financial crisis, right? I mean, Wall Street was protected for the most part, minus Lehman and a few other firms. But Main Street felt it so severely. It does feel, you know, a little bit different this time around. How do we need to kind of think about maybe the Fed approach right now? And we just got a lot from Jay Powell and company, you know, just a few hours ago.
Yeah, I think his overriding message is that if we don't get inflation under control, it doesn't benefit anyone, especially those who are most disadvantaged, because not only is it hurting people in terms of not being able to afford things, but it also means that the cycle can't be longer. You can't have a long business cycle that is more inclusive, that gets the participation rate up. So if he's to achieve what he needs to do, he needs to act now so that in the future, this won't be a problem.
So to what extent does the Fed actually have the tools to do that? These are famously blunt instruments. And as we heard from Doug Cioka over at Kvar Capital Partners, given the supply constraints that are leading to high inflation, we're helping contribute to high inflation when it comes to the supply chain, when it comes to high energy prices. What power does the Fed have to do this?
Well, it was interesting to listen to Jay Powell talk about it. He was quite honest in saying that they don't have all of the tools. You know, obviously they can't work against supply shock. They can't make more computer chips or unclog ports. They can't pump more oil. The only thing they can do in this particular instance is get supply and demand imbalance by crimping demand. That's essentially what they're doing. And he's soft-pedaling that policy by saying, look, we have the JOLTS data, which says that there are so many jobs out there. If we can just reduce the number of jobs, that the supply of jobs, then, as opposed to the supply of labor, then we can get a nice balance there. I thought that was a very good turn of phrase on his part.
Is that something we can do, though? Because I mean, okay, from the perspective of, you know, interest rates and how I'm going to fill up my tank, right? To what extent do higher interest rates lead me to not drive somewhere or lead me to not use energy in my home?
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult because, you know, it sounds good at the aggregate level, but when you break it down to where people actually need jobs and where companies need employees, you get a breakdown there. And I think that we're already seeing on two fronts a breakdown in terms of employment and in terms of business investment. If you looked at the business investment numbers that came out, the GDP now figure went down to 0.0%, showing that they're looking for a contraction in business investment in Q2. And then jobless claims are up 45,000 on average over the last 2 months.
Yeah, I think it's really significant. You know, I was thinking about that in terms of here's our supply chains, our problems, right, Ed? And, you know, in many ways, the energy situation, right, refining, like we need to increase capacity, we need to make these investments, and yet companies aren't doing it. And this is where the Fed can't necessarily help ease those supply chain constraints if companies aren't willing to kind of either amp up production. And so to me, once again, it's a reminder inflation is going to stick around for a lot longer, and that's a lot of pain on Main Street. Just got about 25 seconds.
Yeah, and I think that is a big problem. And, you know, when you think about the oil patch, they're scarred by the shale bust, and I think that the investors want the money. So really, the Fed's between a rock and a hard place.
That was Bloomberg News Senior Markets Editor Ed Harrison.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, she built the fashion brand that bears her name, Tory Burch, on the outlook for her empire and what she's doing to help other women achieve their own success.
This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
The Tory Burch Foundation has provided more than $1.2 million in grants to help women grow their businesses. And the Tory Burch Capital Program has distributed more than $75 million in loans to nearly 4,800 women entrepreneurs.
The foundation hosted its third Embrace Ambition Summit this past week. And just ahead of the event, we had the chance to catch up with Tory Burch. She's, of course, founder, designer, and executive chairman of the company and brand that bears her name. Also the president of the Tory Burch Foundation, Lori Fabiano.
And before we talked about the great things her philanthropic organization is doing, Tory brought us up to speed on the health of her enterprise, We Talked Retail.
We had a record year last year, and then we see the first quarter, it's a lot tougher. But that said, still very optimistic. And we don't see... We obviously are very concerned about inflation and all that's coming. The supply chain issues are extremely challenging, but we're taking one day at a time, and our business is still extremely strong.
Tory, how have you managed the supply chain? I mean, what changes have you had to make as a result of difficulty getting components, as a difficulty in terms of shipping?
Very luckily, many years ago, about 8 years ago, I really wanted to diversify with where we produce things so we weren't dependent on one area. And I think that has helped us a great deal. So we really, really manufacture all over the world. And when one country is down, we're moving supply chain to the next.
Well, and when you think about things like labor, are you getting all the workers you want, whether it's in stores and so on? Or if you are you finding you have to pay up for it?
Well, we are not having trouble hiring people or having the people we need right now. And, you know, I think time will tell what the toll that inflation has in store for us.
What do you mean by that? You're not seeing go ahead.
Well, we are not seeing the full impact that I think that's going to be coming our way. So we are preparing the best we can with the unknown, which we, I think, do know that will get much worse.
Well, how do you prepare as, you know, executive chairman of the company? How do you prepare for what the unknown is?
I mean, the concept of less is more, less of everything, and everything with more integrity, making sure that our teams are in great shape, really, that they're doing well, but focusing on product and innovation. And I think that's something that people are still shopping. They're still wanting to dream. And that's something that we hope will not change.
I love what you said about less is more. And I do wonder, I have a 19-year-old, and she's very strategic in what she buys. She checks where things are made. She wants to understand the company and doesn't shop a lot. But what she buys is, as the mother who pays for it.
She wants it to last, right?
Yes.
Also, I think the consumer has changed. And what's exciting for us is a purpose-driven company is resonating and super important for the world and people that are buying products. They want more to it than just a product.
All right. Can I ask you, and then we're going to move back to the summit. So, Tory, we've talked with you about going public. You've told us that, you know, that's never your plan. Is it really completely off the table? I mean, I get the benefits of being a private company. I see it all the time, public versus private. But I'm just curious.
Well, listen, I can never say never to anything. I don't think you can. But I think being private is a luxury. It's something that I truly love. And I think that we have no plans whatsoever to think in a different way.
And I've got to say, I've enjoyed the conversation, Tory, that we've had over the years when it comes to the work that you guys are doing with your foundation for women entrepreneurs. I have to say, your summit, I'm curious about the tone, the conversations coming off the pandemic, coming off of, again, questionable times when it comes to the economic outlook, that tends to impact minorities and women much more severely. So tell us a little bit about what we can anticipate, Tory, next week.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's very good timing based on some of the things that we all have experienced the last 2 years. It's been a heartbreaking pandemic, obviously, but women have been hit extra hard. And 2 million women have left the job force alone. So you can imagine the impact that takes on women in general, but the economy.
Mm-hmm. Lori, what specifically are you doing at the foundation in order to help these women who have been affected?
We created one program in particular. It's grants for women of color, entrepreneurs, and we did that in partnership with the Fearless Fund and the Crew, and also with some help from Goldman Sachs. And that is literally to provide grants in very quickly to women of color business owners that are in danger of losing their businesses, and we want to see them sustain and thrive. But during the pandemic, we also really pivoted and became one of the primary resources for women trying to get PPP loans and for women in general trying to just get the information they needed to stay in business. We created a web series, and for a while it was running literally every single week with news and information that women entrepreneurs really needed. And tens of thousands of women have been on these on our web series.
You know, Tori, one of the things I remembered from, and it's years ago, and I think it's when you were starting your foundation and you were talking about, you know, these grants for women and entrepreneurs, and, you know, you had this money to allocate, and yet people weren't coming up, or applying for it. What has changed over the years when it comes to women knowing that there are sources out there and accessing, financial help and assistance, whether it's starting a business? And I think about your summit, right? It's now in its third year. The conversations around double standards and stereotypes, how is all of this evolving? And fingers crossed, getting better.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the summit we do every 2 years. And so it's going to be, I think the first one was in 2018. So this will be our third summit. But I think the system and program wasn't right initially. We had to figure it out, and we needed to sort of crack it and realized that we needed to find the women at the right time in the cycle of their business and when they actually needed the loan. So once we did that, we saw the enormous need. And just the program that Lori just mentioned, I can't even tell you. I think there were thousands of applicants that applied.
7,000 applicants.
7,000. Wow. So the need is enormous.
That's Tori Burch, the founder, designer, and executive chairman of Tori Burch, along with Lori Fabiano, president of the Tori Burch Foundation.
Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, how to state your case and make yourself heard in any situation. Tim and I, we're going to debate. Well, no, we're not.
No, we're not, but we are going to get some tips from a world-class debate champion on the other side. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
This next guest, man, does the world need his advice? He's a two-time world champion debater and a former coach of the Australian National Debating Team and the Harvard College Debating Union.
Bo So is a journalist and author from Australia by way of South Korea. He overcame a significant language barrier to become one of the best in his field, and now he reveals some of the tricks of the trade in his new book, Good Arguments, How Debate Teaches Us to Listen and Be Heard.
We're living at a time of really extraordinary polarization, and it's easy in times like that to see disagreement as the source of our troubles. And what I'm trying to suggest with this book is disagreements can be a force for good, not only because they're useful in terms of finding out truths and ensuring people are heard and we can be honest and frank and forthright with each other, but more importantly, because good arguments are what good democracies are, they're what good workplaces are, what good families are, that we, despite our differences, resolve to live together, and instead of ignoring our differences, to put them in conversation with one another with the hope that we might be able to get somewhere deeper, somewhere better, somewhere richer than we might be able to on our own. So my hope with this book is to restore people's confidence in what disagreements can do, and hopefully to give them a few skills that are going to allow them to handle them a little bit better too.
I think that one thing that keeps people back from expressing disagreement in the workplace is perhaps the way that we interpret how other people are going to take that disagreement, the idea of people taking conflict personally. So, Bo, what's a good way to, you know, how should people express themselves in a way where they get to that better place by disagreeing with one another?
I think that's a really important question. And debate is such a big part of the workplace now, isn't it? Because the nature of modern white collar work is just we sit around in meetings and disagree all day. And I think the book gives a few different pieces of advice for someone in that situation. I think the first is you want to be really clear what the disagreement is about. As soon as there's that kind of imprecision about what the conversation is about, it tends to become unruly and it tends to bring in personality. It tends to bring in all the things that has happened in the past. So the first thing I would say is every disagreement starts with an act of agreement, and that's often about what the discussion is about. The next thing that I'd add is you want to have the kind of rules that we started our conversation with. So in competitive debate, you know that everybody gets equal time in which to speak. They're not interrupted while they're speaking, and they're given turns so that when I speak and I give you a chance to speak, there's no need for me to interrupt because I know I'm going to get a turn back.
Is a big part of this, too, is that there doesn't have to be a winner or loser?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that you learn as a competitive debater is wins and losses are temporary. You know, just the way it is in the workplace, you might take a W in this particular conversation or a loss in this particular conversation, but your coworkers aren't going anywhere. Right. And so they're going to be back the next day or the next week, the next month with a different issue where you're all going to be on different sides, sometimes allied, sometimes on opposing sides. So I think the real lesson, in addition to taking seriously the need sometimes to prevail in arguments and to stick up for yourself and to carry your message, is to recognize what we all need is a set of rules, a set of practices that allows us to keep the conversation going in the long term and for the betterment of our organizations and for the betterment of ourselves.
I have to, you know, I think about presidential debates or political debates. Like, do you watch them and you say, well, this isn't a debate. This is just a show. No, seriously, right? Like, because people don't have a chance to kind of say things. There's constantly somebody jumping in and that's not a debate, or is it?
I think that's exactly right. I don't think they are debates, and something isn't a debate just because it's called a debate or because two people are standing at an awkward distance from each other at different podiums, right? And I think often what happens in those debates is one or more of the participants turns what would otherwise be a debate into a kind of a brawl. And it becomes really important in those moments to pause, as you said, at the top of the program, to identify what is happening, to name the kinds of tactics that are being used, whether it be name calling and something like that, and to say, is it a debate that we're having or is it something else? Because without that kind of a check, what begins as a debate can devolve into something worse. And we see that not only on the presidential stage, but we see that around the kitchen table in our with our families and our loved ones. Yeah. And we see it at workplaces all the time.
That's journalist and author Bo So on his new book, Good Arguments, How Debate Teaches Us to Listen and Be Heard. It's out now.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. And if you missed any of it or want to hear the whole conversation, check out our podcast online. Coming up, AB and Bev's all in on ESG. And it's not just about tackling climate change.
What the world's largest brewer is doing to keep you safe at the bar and on the road. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Anheuser-Busch InBev thinks a lot about ESG as it relies on natural resources in a big way. I mean, no water, no beer. It's as simple as that. And that easily makes the business case for the company. And it has set out a series of sustainability goals for 2025 as a result.
It's not just sustainability, though. Part of its ESG mission is smart drinking. For more on what that entails and how the world's largest brewer is thinking about our climate, supply chains, and the health of its consumers, we turn to John Blood. He's the Chief Legal and Corporate Affairs Officer and Company Secretary at AB InBev.
And one of the great things about the beer category is it's an affordable luxury. You can go out this weekend, you can have a Stella Artois, right? You can go in, you can enjoy yourself. The price point is right there. We have a portfolio approach at all different price points. So it's really a great luxury that you can have in these types of times.
I mean, one of the things that I'm so floored with talking to you and your senior executive space is that you guys have to understand your supply chain so well, right? Because it just, if things don't go well, it just all breaks down. And you also understand the impact of climate change on that supply chain in a big way, which is why your sustainability initiatives are really impressive and you've had them in place for a long time. Having said that, how would you describe your supply chains today?
Yeah, for us, if you think about beer, right? For us, take the United States for an example. 98% of what we sell in the U.S. is brewed here. Mm-hmm. We're talking U.S. farmers. We're talking folks in the U.S. making it, distributing it, brewing it, getting it there. So that's 98%. But that doesn't mean we're not immune to the world, right? And that doesn't mean that we also look out and say, what can we do to plan? What can we do to get ahead of things? What tools do we have in our toolkit? And because we're a global business, we have a business in China, we have a business in South America, we have a business in Europe, talking to those folks about what's on the ground is important for us as well.
I want to hear about what you're hearing from the farmers on the ground here in the U.S., because it's been a tough run for farmers with fertilizer prices going up, with severe weather in many parts of the country shortening the season. What are you hearing from barley farmers, from hops farmers?
Yeah, so for barley and hops, this is something that we try to plan out as best as we can, and particularly when you take a look at something like organic. Right, one of the beers that we have is an organic brew, right, called Organic Pure Gold, which is a Michelob Ultra product. And to get someone, right, to a farmer to come in and say, hey, we want you to plant organic barley, right, that's going to take some time, right? We have to work with them. We have to give them those long-term contracts. And we really see ourselves in the industry, and you need to look at yourself as part of the whole chain. So we feel for those farmers. We try to give them those contracts to give them the stability going forward to say, particularly on the organic side, we're going to work with you in the long term so you can transition to that.
John, I feel like this is so into so many of the conversations. We were just talking with Peter Farsi, the CEO of SunPower, and just talking about, you know, certainly when it comes to trade tensions between the U.S. and China, that impacts certainly the solar industry. But I also think about that, you know, what is the responsibility when it comes to our global supply chains? You guys have just taken the initiatives a lot on your own, right, to make sure you ensure the stability and purity of those supply chains. What is, though, the government role, especially when it comes to things like, and I know this isn't your wheelhouse, but whether it's semiconductors or water or what have you, because some of this becomes like national security issues. And I do wonder, is your responsibility, you know, I'm sure you're dealing with folks in Washington from time to time.
Sure.
So I do wonder the conversations that are coming out or that need to be that we need to be having when it comes to our national supply chains, especially coming off of the pandemic.
Yeah, well, I love this question because it really hits home that if you think as a business executive, you're going to solve any of this by yourself and you're going to sit in your room and you're going to get a PowerPoint open, you're going to plan something out, you are mistaken. You need to work with partnerships. You need to work with your stakeholders. And the first thing to understand is who are your stakeholders. So your stakeholders are national governments. Your stakeholders are farmers. Your stakeholders are these consumers. But your stakeholders are the communities as well, where you're looking for these supplies to come out of. So if, in fact, you're working with folks who farm in another country, what are you doing with them to make sure that they're planning? How can you give them something as simple as maybe financial literacy? We have a program where we work with a lot of our farmers to say, we want to help you become better farmers. But more importantly, we're not going to teach you that. You're going to learn from other farmers in other countries.
Right.
You're going to learn from other farmers down the street. And we'll put that together so you can understand when the weather changes, about what's the best technique. You can share that, because at the end of the day, that community is something that can learn from each other, and we can be a vehicle to that.
One thing we wanted to get to, because you are a company that has really laid out sustainability goals. We talk a lot about ESG, getting a reckoning, and people wanting transparency. As part of ESG, though, you guys think about safe drinking. Talk to us, or smart drinking. Talk to us about that and how it fits in. Because, right, we're living in a world where there are multiple stakeholders, and that includes our consumer.
Yeah, thanks, Carol. When I think about smart drinking, right, when I think about what we do with our product, right, I think about my family, right? My kids ride their bikes on the street, right? I want to make sure that we have the best programs for anti-drunk driving. Right. I want to make sure that we have the best programs for people to remind them about smart drinking. Mm-hmm. Really what we call social norms marketing. This is something where you're not just in the old days of like, hey, we're going to raise awareness, right? That's 10, 20 years ago. This is evidence-based programs that give people actionable advice. Now, it's simple actionable advice. It'll be things like hydrate between drinks, have a non-alcohol beer with the beer, eat before and while you drink. Simple things like don't drink if you're pregnant. Plan to have a ride home. Those are the social norms advertising that's away from drink responsibly, drink responsibly. We do want people to drink responsibly, but we need more than that. Today, you need to be more action oriented.
What prompted that change? Because drink responsibly is something that I remember going back, you know, decades at this point when it comes to marketing. What changed this to actionable advice? What was that pivotal point?
Two things, Tim. One is the science, right? When we work with academics, they tell us this actionable advice, this social norm advice can make a difference. And the second is, about 5 years ago, right, we were looking at our programs and we said, we have all these smart drinking programs around the world and we think they work. We've been doing them for years. And then we asked ourselves, does anyone have any data if they work or not? Has anyone tested this, and how do you test it? And that's where the process started. We wanted to test it. We wanted to make it evidence-based. And by the way, we share the evidence with all those who want to look. We have a foundation that does it. We work with academics. Whoever wants to look can look at it. We test the programs and go with the ones that have the biggest and best impact.
What's the biggest piece of advice, you know, for our kids? Like, I grew up in a family where older parents, I don't know, like different era, like, there was alcohol in the house, and I had my first drink with my parents, you know, at a relatively young age, for better or for worse. But I am responsible about drinking today. But like, how do we approach this with kids?
Yeah, and this is a fascinating question, because you take a look at the U.S. and you take a look at the rest of the world, right?
Europe.
There are cultural norms, or right? Elsewhere. There are laws as well. Of course, we tell kids, do not drink, right? When the law says whatever it is, that's the law, you need to enforce it. However, right, when we deal with alcohol, right, when we deal with what we call these social norms, it's so important, right, that when we deal with it, we remember that alcohol is often part of the special, and beer in particular is part of those meaningful moments in life. When someone says, let's grab a beer, right, they're in part talking about the beer, but they're talking about the social connection. Oftentimes mm-hmm. when someone says, let's grab a beer, they want to have a meaningful interaction with you, right? They want to have a real conversation. They want to be together. And sort of balancing that in the right way is what you really need to talk to everyone about, right? You need to talk to them about, this is how you respect the product. This is how you enjoy the product, by treating it the right way. And that's what smart drinking is all about, reminding people. It's like nudging them, right? Social norms also is about, some people might think, oh, on Thursday night, my friends go out and they drink 6 or 7 beers. You know what? When you look at the data, it's not the case.
Right.
Right? They're drinking 1 or 2. When you remind people of that,
yeah,
you can then nudge and change the social norm so people behave differently. And that's what social norms is all about.
What about when it comes to drunk driving right now? Because Anheuser-Busch's Decide to Ride campaign has partnered with Uber. And I think back to just my own experience in my 20s. And I lived in the mountains and there was no Uber. There was no Lyft.
Right.
There was a huge problem where I lived when it came to drunk driving. There was this terrible joke that, you know, to be a local in Vail, you needed to have ACL surgery and a DUI. Because then you really live there. And I wonder how much Uber and Lyft and ride hailing has changed this, because it is so easy to find a ride.
You know, it is all about sort of embracing the moment, right? When technology gives you something that allows you to nudge society towards a healthier pattern, towards a social norm that's positive, you need to embrace it. And that's why we're so happy with Uber and Mothers Against Drunk Driving, right, is part of that program of Decide to Ride, right? Saying to folks, you know what, there is a solution. And it's very important to remember, Tim, as well, when we talk about Decide to Ride, it's not just, oh, hey, you get a free ride home or you get a discount ride home. It's about the mindset of I'm going to plan to ride. And I love your generational approach here, because if you talk to the 21, 22, 23-year-olds, right, it's almost instinctual now. Like, No, I'm going to use Uber. Why would I take the risk? Why would I do this? And it's a different mindset, because I'm a little older than you, Tim, but I remember that attitude even worse. And what social norms about is nudging, is changing the way people behave and act. And that mindset is super powerful. And that's why you see drunk driving numbers over the last 10, 20, 30 years coming down.
Our thanks to John Blood, AB InBev's Chief Legal and Corporate Affairs Officer and Company Secretary.
You can catch that full conversation on our podcast feed. That wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
Also, check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take, available at Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Stay safe, and if you do drink, drink responsibly. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success. It's discipline. It's teamwork. It's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. And it's why Stifel is one of the fastest growing global wealth management and investment banking firms in the industry. Stifel. It's where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated. Member SIPC and NYSE.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.